All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Nebraska is now open for the transaction of business. Draw nigh, all ye having business with this honorable court, and ye shall be heard. God save the state of Nebraska and this honorable court.
Thank you. You may be seated. Good morning to everyone. We will begin with introductions from the court. I am Mike Hevekin, and I am the Chief Justice. And now, by order of seniority, as to service on the court, the other members of the court present will introduce themselves.
Good morning. I'm Lindsay Miller-Lerman.
William Castle. Good morning.
I am Jeff Funk.
Jonathan Papik. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm John Freidenberg.
Thank you, members of the court. And I should note that Justice Stephanie Stacy could not be with us today, but she will be participating on the briefs for all three of this morning's oral arguments. And I should also introduce our bailiff, Allie Stewart. And with that, our first case of the day is State versus Dapp. Is it Mr. Sabat?
Yes.
Good morning to you, and Ms. Tangeman, good morning to you. Do either of you have any questions before we begin?
No.
Then, Mr. Sabat, you may approach and you may proceed.
Thank you.
Chief Justice Hevekin, Justices, may it please the court, I represent the defendant, the appellant who was prosecuted by the state of Nebraska in the Hall County District Court for multiple crimes, including possession of a deadly weapon by a prohibited person, unlawful discharge of a firearm, use of a deadly weapon to commit a felony, and obstructing a peace officer. The defendant was ultimately convicted of these charges after a bench trial. Most of the evidence centered around one witness's testimony. She testified that she heard a disturbance outside of her apartment. She looked outside, saw the defendant on the landing. She heard a gunshot, then looked outside, saw the defendant on the landing. That prompted her to call 911. She recognized the defendant as someone that lived in the same apartment complex.
She saw the defendant with something in his hand?
Yes. She saw something in the defendant's hand, and she could not confirm what it was. She also testified that she heard the defendant say, next time I won't miss. The witness heard two shots, okay? One was outside, which prompted her to look outside, and she opened her door, and she also testified that she heard a shot later inside.
And that first shot, do we know where it went, or
no? So
it hit anything? Do we know anything about that?
No. So
do we have a casing?
They found a casing outside on the landing where the defendant was observed by the witness. There was another witness inside her apartment that heard the gunshot, but all the testimony was that specifically the witness testified that she did not know the direction of the gunshot outside, where that was aimed. She did not see it shot. Casings were found there. And she was then outside when she heard a shot inside the building. And Investigators did find a shell casing inside the apartment, and it was discovered on a they were on a couch next
when you,
to.
When you say inside the apartment, I take it that's not the witness's apartment, correct?
Correct. And this was, and so the shell casings were found on a couch inside of an apartment next to the defendant's wallet. Investigators later observed a hole in the ceiling near the couch. And they did search in the attic. They never found anything. And they also, there was another witness that appeared, or perhaps at the scene, but she requested an attorney, and they did not get any information from her. That's the issue that I want to focus on.
What is the evidence about who was in the apartment where the second shot apparently took place?
Well, circumstantially, it looks with Dap's wallet there, and or with the defendant's wallet there, that's what they believe that the defendant was in there.
Did the witness see Mr. Dapp go into that apartment?
I don't believe so, no.
Was there anybody else in that apartment?
I don't believe so, no. And
does the record tell us that was Mr. Dapp's apartment?
I don't believe it was his apartment. And that's the issue that I want to focus on here today is that, the fact that the evidence at trial was insufficient to support the findings that the defendant unlawfully discharged the firearm under 28.12.02, and the statute states that unlawfully and intentionally discharges a firearm at an inhabited dwelling. And so
are you talking now about the first shot or the second shot?
Well, let's talk about the first shot. So the first shot, there's no evidence about direction at all. And there wasn't any evidence presented about direction at all. There was the sound, and but as is required, that to be shot at a dwelling.
Didn't the witness from across the way testify that the others were in an apartment catty corner from the witness's front door?
Perhaps. Yes, but I still, there isn't any, I mean, I guess there what? Still isn't any testimony about, I'm sorry.
What about the statement that next time I won't miss, or something to that effect?
Yeah, I mean, it still doesn't, it still doesn't give us any sort of direction or any sort of, where the shot was pointed and on the outside. And if, we've got, State v. Morton, the defendant withdrew the gun when, that addresses, where we've sort of addressed this statute before, it states, the state's factual basis was sufficient because the defendant withdrew the gun from his pocket and pointed it toward the front porch and fired. In State v. Wells, the evidence showed defendant intentionally shot at an occupied dwelling, and defendant did not have to aim at a certain part of the building. So here we don't even have any evidence about any sort of aiming or direction or any intent.
Do we have circumstantial evidence of that? Adding together with the statement of where the others were and next time I won't miss.
I think that's just grasping to try. I mean, the statute's clear. It says it's got to be pointed at a dwelling, and that element was just not addressed. There wasn't any evidence.
I'm trying to follow that. Your focus is on the word at.
Mm-hmm.
So if you shoot a weapon inside an apartment, that's not at?
So
therefore, it's not a crime? Is that your argument?
Well, it's not the crime as charged. It's not for unlawful discharge of a firearm at a dwelling, is what I would argue. You know, and there have been distinctions now that we're talking, you know, the shot inside. There's been distinctions in other states where we have, you know, we're in New Mexico, as shooting within a motor vehicle is not the same as shooting at or from, and so we've got sort of the or.
So is your argument you have to be outside shooting?
Well, the argument
into
is
into a dwelling.
Well, I think if you know the plain language of the statute, it's unambiguous. I don't think there's any interpretation that's needed, and it says at. And if the legislature or wanted it to be within, they could have used within. And I think that as the crime as charged, unlawful discharge of a firearm at a dwelling, it was charged incorrectly, and the state was unable. They didn't even address the elements of it.
Before your time completely expires, do you want to talk about the portion of your motion for new trial addressed to the comments of the judge?
I guess I think you're speaking to the judge made a comment that, yeah, well, once we determine that he's had a gun, then they all sort of, then I guess he's guilty of all of these things. Is that what you're referring to?
I think that's not precisely the language, but that's the general gist.
Yeah. And I guess that's just incorrect, I think, because you could determine that he had the gun, but...
Was the judge was the finder of fact?
Yes.
And I haven't seen any authority cited in your brief that it somehow is improper for the finder of fact in a bench trial to comment on the evidence. Are you contending that it is improper for some reason?
No.
You're just quarreling with his evaluation of the evidence.
I suppose, yes.
Are you suggesting there's an error of law by the judge who did not perhaps recognize what the elements, separate elements were of the separate crimes, and is inferring from possession that these other crimes are therefore naturally committed? Is this an error of law?
Yes, I believe so, and just because there wasn't any analysis done at all, because there couldn't be, because there wasn't any evidence on it with regards to the direction of either of these shots, and without that evaluation, I don't see how the judge was able to come to the conclusion that he came to, that element was fulfilled.
Thank you.
And because of that,
I know your time has expired, but with the chief's indulgence, I'll ask you one question about the ineffective assistance of counsel claims. The state, in its brief, has asked us to take judicial notice of things apparently in the court file of the trial court. What's your take on that request?
Um, I am not sure. I guess I would I haven't contemplated that, so I'm not sure, Your Honor.
Very well. Thank you.
May I ask for relief briefly? No? Time's up?
Time is up, I believe.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Tangeman, good morning again.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Erin Tangeman, Assistant Attorney General representing the State of Nebraska. I'm going to work backwards. I'll start with your question about judicial notice. I did not write the brief in this case. It was one of my former colleagues, and I would disagree with probably the judicial notice position that we took. I think the Court can take judicial notice of certain cases, but we also have to adhere to the appellate rules, which if we wanted the Court to take notice of filings in this case, we could have submitted a supplemental transcript. I think ultimately it doesn't matter for the claim because I don't think that the claim was necessary that he didn't see his discovery, but that the claim was about his counsel's communication with him and reviewing the discovery. And so I don't think whether or not the Court had access to those certificate of compliances helped either way.
That was an alternative basis argued in the brief to the original position, which was the record was insufficient.
Correct.
So are you now adhering to the record is insufficient?
Yes, I think for all of the ineffective claims, if this Court finds that they're properly alleged, we are probably on a record insufficient
basis. So are there some that you think are not properly alleged?
It's always tricky with the lack of investigation, lack of communication. I do think there's more detail in the argument here than in other cases that I have seen.
Focusing on the assignments of error, are they specifically?
The assignment of error is specific enough for the claim regarding counsel's advice for failure to testify. I think the other one is lumped together with a few bullet points, and I guess I'd leave that to this Court's discretion on whether that is sufficient. It does give a topic area, but it doesn't fully explain.
Doesn't the claim have to be specific enough that we or anybody else has some idea of what further investigation would have
found? Yes, and I think it gets back to how much is necessary in the assignment of error, because counsel does expand on what he claims was the error in his argument. So it is up to this Court to determine whether or not what's in the assignment of error was sufficiently alleged. To the extent that it was, we do agree that the record's insufficient because it does get into communications with counsel regarding the trial. I'll go back to the sufficiency of the evidence regarding the unlawful discharge conviction. To be found guilty under the statute, the evidence must establish the defendant unlawfully and intentionally discharged a firearm at an inhabited dwelling or occupied building. The relevant statute does not require the state to prove the location of the shooter. It does not require the shooter to be outside of the building when the shot was fired. The state was only required to prove that the shot was fired at the building, and those elements were met in this case by the circumstantial evidence.
Which inhabited building are you talking about here?
And I believe it was Unit F of this apartment complex. The witness testified that she and the, I guess, victim, for lack of a better word in this case, they lived up on the second floor of this unit, and that the staircase was on the outside. It was partially enclosed. It had a roof over it, some walls. And the defendant was standing there yelling at the person who was in the apartment that was catty-corner from the witnesses. That is where the state submits the shot was fired, even though we don't have direct evidence of that, just because of where the shell casing was found. The defendant's statement that next time I won't miss, which indicates that he was shooting at the person who was standing on the balcony area by his apartment.
You concede it's a purely circumstantial.
Yes.
There's no direct evidence.
There's no direct evidence.
And so the second shot was not a shot at an inhabitant inhabited residence?
The position that the state is taking in this case is that it meets the statutory definition because we have a shot fired into the ceiling of a residence. And so because the statute doesn't differentiate between a shooter standing outside versus inside, we think it works under the facts of this case. That's not to say every shot fired in a house is going to meet that definition, but it appears that the defendant in this case was firing a shot at the building to intimidate or scare or whatever he was doing, and then he then went into the apartment and did the exact same thing into the ceiling.
Do we even have to reach the shot inside the apartment?
No. I think the shot outside is sufficient, and he was only charged with one count of unlawful discharge.
Do we have any record as to whether or not there was an apartment above the ceiling of the second shot?
There was not. It was an attic. I mean, the attic was accessible, as the law enforcement was able to get in there after to see if they could find the bullet. So it was something that people could access, but it was not a separate apartment.
So the shot was inside an apartment?
Yes.
Hit part of the apartment?
Yes.
Somebody was in the apartment?
Yes.
Is that not a shot at an inhabited dwelling?
I mean, the state's position is that it is, yes. And we would...
It didn't shoot out the window. It didn't
right.
shoot out the door.
Right.
There's a shell casing and a bullet through the roof and
right.
damage in the ceiling and in the attic.
Right. And we don't think the legislature intended to, if the defendant was standing on the roof or next to the building, to shoot down into the ceiling, but not up into the ceiling. We think that would be an absurd result just based on the pure statutory language, because there's nothing in the statute regarding the location of the shooter. And just record-wise, I do think that the...
Well, let me ask you one more question about that. What's the state's position with respect to whether that statute at is ambiguous?
I've struggled with this because the cases that the defendant cites finds the word at to be ambiguous. I think the plain reading, giving the simplicity of the statute, you could find that it's not ambiguous because it is talking about discharging a weapon at a building, and I think that has common knowledge. I guess that would be my position. I'm not sure, but we'll go with not ambiguous, and that at is at the direction of the building.
If it were ambiguous and we looked at the legislative history, is there anything there that would help us?
The statute was enacted in 1990, and most of the discussion in the Judiciary Committee was about
drive-by shootings.
Drive-by shootings, but they wanted language of the bullet striking the location. So yes, drive-by shootings, but they also discussed that the statute was broader than that, that somebody walking by, I think one of the senators even said, if I took a gun out now and shot at this wall. So I don't think that the legislative history leans one way or the other regarding the inside. But I would submit that the case cited in our brief from Justice Smith Camp of the Federal District Court that interpreted the statute to be inside was sufficient when someone was shooting inside at a ceiling.
Have there been amendments to either that statute or the surrounding statute since 1990? And I'm having some recollection, but I could be in the wrong statute about cities of the X class and what the local ordinances can do and forth.
Yeah, that's a separate statute. I don't know exactly when that was enacted. It does have more language than the statute does regarding being in a vehicle or leaving a vehicle at the time. This statute was amended.
And authorizing cities of the XYZ class to do local ordinances, things of that nature. Rather than state statute.
Right.
Okay.
And then this statute, when it was first enacted in 1990, included language of discharging and striking an occupied building or dwelling, and then in 1995 they amended that and took out the striking language part. So now the statute reads as is. There was another amendment, but I think that was changing something small. It wasn't anything specific.
Thank you.
You want to talk about the judge's comment?
I think the judge, it kind of depends on how you look at the order of things, because if the judge found that the defendant was guilty as the trier of fact of the unlawful discharge and the use, then yes, the possession goes along with that. But at the same time, I do think the judge was incorrect that if for some reason the statutory elements were not met with the unlawful discharge, that and the use would probably fall because they are intertwined, but that he could still be found guilty of possession. I think ultimately the judge didn't say it was impossible. He said it might be difficult, but ultimately he did find the evidence was sufficient on each separate ground. I don't think there's any error. I think it ties back to the sufficiency of the evidence. So it was no error.
Does the comment reflect an error of law, a misunderstanding of the applicable statute?
No, I think it was factual based. I think he was taking it based on what the parties were arguing at the time of closing arguments.
Thank you.
We would ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? We do not. So, counsel, that concludes arguments in State versus DAP. So you are excused. And the court will go on to the next case of the day, which is State versus Lara.